Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Did you know that Off Camera was also a television show? Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that we are a podcast, a magazine, and a television show. But what you may not know is you can watch full episodes in glorious black and white on our own website, offcamera.com. And now we've made that even easier by creating a monthly subscription so you can watch all the Off Camera you want. For only $4.99, you can subscribe to Off Camera and binge watch until the cows come home. And not only that, but new episodes pop up every week, so you can always stay up to date with the show. If you haven't yet checked it out, it's a whole different way to experience Off Camera. As you're listening to these stories, you can watch these thoughts form on these artists' faces, and it feels like you're right there in the room during the conversation. So check that out. It's a great option to the podcast, and it's also a great way to support the show. So check that out at offcamera.com. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And this time, I sit down with actress Rachel Brosnahan. Ever since she was a little girl, traveling back and forth between Chicago and London with a carry-on bag filled with books, Rachel Brosnahan has been a lover of storytelling. Eventually, the joy of entering the world of fantasy and exploring her imagination opened Rachel's eyes to the performing arts. By the time she applied to college, becoming an actress was her goal, despite the concerns of her parents. As Rachel says, nobody wants their kid to come home and say, "Mom, Dad, I'm going to be an actress." My parents were terrified. They were like, "But you're so smart, please do something else." Rachel wouldn't budge from her dream, but the resistance from her parents served her well and fosters a sense of independence and determination. As she says, "If you tell me I can't, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to go all the way." That focus paid off. After 4 years at NYU's prestigious Tisch School, Rachel landed a role in Netflix hit series House of Cards as the mysterious call girl Rachel Posner. What was originally a two-episode commitment turned into a reoccurring role and a launching pad for Rachel's career, including projects like Manhattan and most recently Amazon's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, for which she won a Golden Globe. As Midge Maisel, Rachel takes on her first lead role as a housewife who accidentally discovers she is a stand-up comedian in 1950s New York City. The role required a deep commitment into research about the era, feminism, and stand-up comedy, which came with a fair amount of discomfort. As Rachel says, "When I really love something, I'm the most anxious about it and feel the most vulnerable doing it. I feel fulfilled and petrified simultaneously, and it's the best feeling." That's why Rachel believes suffering for her art is a necessary part of the process, because if she doesn't feel absolutely terrible, it's probably not very good. She did draw the line at actually performing stand-up, however, explaining that if she was playing a doctor, she wouldn't actually perform surgery as part of her research. Fair point. Rachel joins Off Camera to discuss why it's so difficult to teach art, the depth she'll go to research and mine a character, and what really happens between Chapter 3 and Chapter 4. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I love your show, The Marvelous Thanks. Mrs. Maisel. And it's so interesting the way I found it because, you know, you had a Golden Globe nomination before, I would say 90% of anybody had even heard of the show.
Yeah, me too, basically.
I mean, you're like, I think I'm on this show.
It happened pretty fast. It was nice though, because it was genuinely a surprise.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. I bet. And in a way, it's sort of tantalizing to go, oh, now I have to watch this show because the actress got nominated for a Golden Globe.
Well, that's the best part about all that stuff is I think sometimes that stuff can feel kind of weird and disconnected from the work,
you right.
know, the accolade-y things. But really, as Frances McDormand once said, it's a giant commercial and it's great.
True.
Free advertising.
And I wonder if when you got nominated for the show, if it almost felt like not earned or, you know what I mean? Like,
totally.
Because no one knows about it, no one's talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think more than anything, it just felt like a really pleasant surprise. Yeah. And it was so encouraging. You know, we made this show that we're really proud of and we all love, but you never know if people are gonna love it as much as you do. And like, there's so much great TV out there right now. It's harder and harder to find things, but there's more and more options, which is also great. There's a lot more platforms to distribute content on, a lot more work for actors out there, for creators, for directors, for writers. But now you also see for all the shows, I mean, I love snubs. I love a good snub. I mean, I'm sure it feels terrible from the inside, but where something has deserved to be recognized for so long, and you're like, they've been snubbed every year, and then they finally get recognized. That's amazing. But this also felt like a really nice welcome to the this era of television for the show. And it was, I think a lot of people found the show through the Golden Globes. It was nice to hear people go, I'd never heard of this, and I checked it out because of the Globes. It was very fortunate.
I read something that really resonated with me because I have daughters, and they are at that age where they are, you know, middle school and elementary school, and they're reading. Mm-hmm. And I read that you were a pretty big bookworm as a kid, and that your dad was in children's publishing,
exactly. So I had bookshelves and bookshelves full of books, and I used to travel a lot. I'm half British, and so we used to go back and forth between England and the U.S. a lot, visiting my mom's family. And
so every you'd read time, on the plane.
Yeah, and the whole time we were there, you know, I didn't know anyone there. I wasn't hanging out with a lot of friends in England. It makes me sound like a big loser, but I would pack in a carry-on. I would just bring a carry-on on the plane, and all that would be in there would be books, just stacks and stacks and stacks of books. And then I would leave them at my grandparents' house in England and buy a whole new set of books to bring back to the States with me.
So you were the kid at school at lunch reading, and like you were...
I read with all of my free time.
You did.
I never got car sick, so I would read in the car, anywhere. You know, I Irish danced a little bit as a child, and it was kind of far from my house, so it was like an hour each way. I would read the whole car ride. I always had my face in a book. I loved reading. It helped open my imagination really early.
Yeah, what do you think that experience had on... Because obviously you didn't become a writer, you became an actor. So something about storytelling didn't make you want to say, I want to write books, I want to be these characters, right?
Yeah, it was about empathy, I think. My favorite part about reading books was the part where it talked about what they were thinking and how they were experiencing the world. And I used to like to think about what they were thinking between scenes. You know, that was something I did a lot when I was reading books. Well, between here and when you next meet them, happened and what were they thinking?
So at the end of chapter 3 and the beginning of chapter 4, you're like, what happened? Did they go to the bathroom?
Three days went by, you know, what did they do in those 3 days? It always felt like I was connected to the characters, but also loved and was mostly attracted to books where the worlds that they took place in were worlds I couldn't imagine.
I think that that's, you know, What reading did for me was it made me more aware that there were more perspectives than my own and my parents and my friends.
Absolutely, yeah.
So do you think that having that sort of, because I also saw books as friends, you know, or as ways to.
Yeah, it feels like it happened for me as a happy accident. It happened out of necessity that I traveled a lot. I traveled alone sometimes. You know, when my little sister was born, I got shipped off to the UK for 3 or 4 weeks by myself with my grandparents. And so it was something to do, something that kept me occupied and something I loved deeply. And I also had friends in school who loved to read. So we loved to read the same books and then talk about the books that we'd read together. I joined one of those like book teams, it sounds like a huge nerd. I was a pretty big nerd.
No, this is good. You're on a book team.
Joined like a book team where you had to read a certain number of books and talk and answer questions about the books. I just remembered that actually.
Pretty early on, did you discover like, I like performing, I like entering into my own fantasy worlds and...
Yeah, I think slowly, and without always being conscious of it, I grew up in a really arts-heavy community.
Okay.
And so we did little school plays, and every class did a play. And so I loved that stuff. that was my favorite part about going to school. I loved art class. I loved painting and singing and playing instruments. And
you weren't shy. You weren't an introvert. You were fine with being on stage.
Yes, I was fine being on stage. I wasn't shy, but I wasn't one of those kids who was super extroverted. Although we used to put on performances in the neighborhood. But I sometimes listen to friends of mine talk about like how attention-loving they were as kids, you know,
right.
And I wasn't quite like that. I was a little bit private sometimes, I think. Didn't want people to see anything until I felt like I'd really rehearsed it. You know, I wasn't just going to start singing. I wanted it to be good before I did it. But I was a little bit self-critical. I didn't like to do anything if I didn't feel like I was good at it, or that I could be good at it. But I liked to learn, and I liked to practice. Practicing was kind of my favorite part. I would spend hours and hours and hours practicing something.
Really?
Yeah.
So memorizing or?
Memorizing. I picked up the violin at some point. I wasn't great at it, but I really liked doing it, and then I switched to the cello. I played the cello for a little while. I was not always great at homework. You know,
right,
it was hard
right.
to get me to sit down and do homework for
yeah.
math and things that I didn't really care about. But I loved music and performing. I would spend hours and hours and hours working on lines and learning cello music and practicing singing. And, you know, and I'm still a little bit like that. I think rehearsal is actually my favorite part.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder why.
I get a lot of anxiety when you actually have to do it, you know? When there's actually an audience in the room, I'm like, oh, God. And the idea of doing film and realizing that people are actually going to see it causes me a lot of anxiety.
So but the joy for you is when it's nobody else's and it's just yours. And
yeah, or like when we're practicing and there are no stakes, and when you're playing with other actors and directors, and that's my favorite part. I love costume fittings. I love finding the exact right costumes and changing little things.
Right.
I love rehearsal. I love the doing of it. And the stakes are sometimes the part that makes it slightly less fun.
I get that. Among your friends, were you like an organizer and or were you like what? Who were you in your friend group?
I feel like I had a lot of different friend groups at various different points. I had a lot of different interests. I did some sports in high school, but also did theater and sort of had different groups that shared various interests.
Right.
But I liked to organize. I mean, I'm trying to think back, but like in our neighborhood growing up, I would definitely help organize like the circus that we would put on in somebody's
oh,
backyard.
Really?
You know? Yeah.
You wanted to
yeah.
do stuff.
Yes, I did. I liked to do stuff. I wanted to make stuff.
So I'm curious if you at one point, if acting became so much more, I don't know, if it like grabbed you to the point where it rose to the top of all your interests.
It did, absolutely. I think in high school that happened. I was still playing sports in high school, but I definitely, this is the most literal and silly example of this, but so I wrestled in high school for a brief period.
You did?
I did. And
gosh, your ears look really good. I didn't.
Well, you know, I did wear my headgear all the time. I didn't wrestle without it. I don't have cauliflower ear. I never ended up with that. But yeah, I did that for a little bit, and I grew up pretty athletic. My family's really athletic.
Okay.
My dad skied for years and years and years. He played tennis really competitively. My siblings both played soccer for a long time. My brother was a diehard hockey guy all the way until he got injured when he was 18 and had to give it up, unfortunately. But that was all he was doing. My sister's playing D1 soccer in college right now. Like, I grew up in
really?
A really athletic family. So I think that was part of the multiple interest thing, is that was always going to be a part of my life.
Right.
And I had friends who did all that stuff, which is how I ended up wrestling anyway. A lot of my friends joined the team, and it was always something I've been interested in. And wrestling's great because it's done by weight class. So there's nothing, I mean, no disadvantage because of my gender. I weigh the
sure.
same as
right,
whoever
right.
I'm wrestling, and we have different skill sets and different things that make us better or worse than each other. And everybody's different. It felt very improvisational. It was cool to be a part of a team, but also working individually.
Right.
I loved it. But the silly example of this is that the reason I joined actually my freshman year of high school was because the musical swapped seasons every other year. So my freshman year of high school, it was in the winter.
Okay.
And I didn't make the musical. And so I needed something to do, and a lot of my friends were wrestling, so I joined the wrestling team in the winter. And then the next year, it was in the spring. So I did the musical in the spring, or I wrestled in the winter and did the musical in the spring. And then my junior year, they fell on the same season again. And so I I did cats instead of wrestling that year.
They're like, huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I was going to go back my senior
year. Imagine if you'd just gone the other way.
I know. But I was definitely more interested in theater and performing than sports.
What was it that got you?
Just doing it. I'd fallen in love with it in junior high, mostly musicals. I fell in love with it through musicals, and I'm actually not a great singer or a great dancer, but that was how I fell in love with performing, was through singing and through musical theater.
Mm-hmm. Did you get some big parts in musicals?
No, I was mostly in the chorus.
Really?
Yeah.
And it was still enough for you to go, this is something I
can
do. I
loved it, yeah. And then I started doing plays in school and realized at some point that I really had no other interests that I would have gone to study in college. I sort of went, well, I gotta go to drama school.
Really?
Yeah.
So you were that serious about it at that point?
Yes.
And
I knew
it was
all I wanted to do. You know, nobody wants their kid to come home and be like, Mom, Dad, I'm gonna be an actor. You know, they were horrified.
Were they?
Yeah,
yeah, I can
they
imagine.
Were like, but you're so smart, you know, please do something else. But they were great. They were tough on me about it. They were sort of like, if you really want to do this, then you're gonna have to do it yourself.
How do you mean?
So I wanted to take acting classes in Chicago. You know,
right.
I was in Chicago at a huge arts community and presence, and you know, acting classes are kind of expensive, and they were like, get babysitting.
Oh, really?
Get a job, you know? Yeah. And so I babysat a lot. I worked at Abercrombie Kids, and I was a waitress for a little while and saved up and took this acting class, got my first set of headshots, and coached for college auditions, and ended up at NYU.
And was one more against it than the other, or did they want to test you? Or
yeah, they weren't fully against it. I think they were just nervous. They
yeah.
knew how hard it was and how few people are able to turn that into a lifelong career. You know, they weren't the kinds of parents who were sort of like, you can do anything and you're the best at it. They were sort of like, do you really think that's good enough? And maybe you should work a little harder. And is
right.
that one class going to be enough for you to, you know? But that was supportive. I think it made me really self-sufficient. It made me work really hard. I felt like I had something to prove to them and to myself. And it made me, it was hard, and it made me 100% certain early on that was what I wanted to do.
Right.
It couldn't be a hobby. It would involve a lot of work.
Is there an early example when you thought, oh, maybe they're right, or maybe this is a bad choice? Like, did you ever have doubts?
No, I think I was a little bit rebellious. I felt like if I had them, they were pushed way far back. I was a little bit like, if you tell me I can't, I'm gonna all the way, you know?
Right.
Like, I was kind of intense about it.
I wonder if your parents knew that about you and
I'm sure they did. I was motivated by the slight amount of doubt or fear or, you know, I felt like I had something to prove and I wanted to be able to prove it.
Right.
And fell further in love with it along the way. I got to do all the other things that I loved doing through acting. I've learned weird and random skills and gotten to travel the world and play people that are so far from
yeah.
myself and play around in worlds that I couldn't imagine. I get to time travel for a living right now. And that's pretty cool. And that feels like it connects all the way back to growing up loving reading. And I haven't yet done kind of an action movie, but I'd love to, because I still would love to play around with that more athletic side that still exists.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here to talk about your teeth. The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and most of us forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing. But not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. But here's where Quip is really unique. Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And I'll have you know, I took my teeth to Idaho a few weeks ago, and I took my Quip toothbrush with me. And it's all true. It sticks to the mirror, and it becomes a cover. It's pretty neat. And finally, everybody loves Quip. They were just on Oprah's O list and named one of Time's best inventions. And Quip is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day, myself included. So here's the deal. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you'll get your first free refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. So I'm going to call out to all the off-camera listeners to try Quip out. I use it every day. I'm assuming that you all have very nice teeth and you want to keep them that way. So give it a shot and know that when you get a Quip toothbrush and try it out, you're not only taking care of your mouth, but you're also supporting off-camera. So go to getquip.com/off-camera. And remember, you get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. So it's spelled getquip.com/off-camera. So try it out and send me an email. Tell me what you think. And now, if everyone has brushed their teeth and has their PJs on, let's get back to the show.
Did discovering acting change your social group at school? Like, did it give you a sense of outsider status, or I'm an artist now? Like I'm curious, when kids do discover something that they love, maybe some of the things that other kids get caught up in school, they fall by the wayside a little bit.
Yeah, my school was weird this way. It didn't really fit the mold of a lot of those, like, you know, the theater kids are sort of the dorks and the sports people are cool. And my school, as I said, had a really heavy focus on the arts. We literally had a program called Focus on the Arts, where every other year we would take 3 days off of classes. The entire school would take 3 days off of classes. And all of these artists from various disciplines would come in and speak to us. And you would go in and you would sign up for all of these classes that would fill 3 days worth of school.
Really?
In all different aspects of the arts, from animators to designers to musicians to performers. It was the coolest thing. And so, and in our school, it was required that you took a certain number of arts classes. So all the athletes were in chorus, you know, because—
No kidding.
Yeah, so there was this big blending of all the different groups. And that's not to say, you know, there were certainly groups that
sure.
only did one thing or the other, but a lot of athletes did and fell in love with theater in my school. A lot of the guys I wrestled with were in chorus.
Wait, would you co-ed wrestle?
Yeah, it's one of those sports where there's really no difference. It's all done by weight.
Well, see, at that age, I was smaller than most of the girls. Like when I was a freshman, sophomore
were.
In high school, I was so tiny,
Yeah, girls just like small and skinny, Yeah, I kicked some ass.
All right, so tell me about, like, so you went off, you went to NYU, right?
Yeah.
You went to Tisch. So how does that work in a school like NYU? There's so many disciplines, right?
Well, they place you.
Okay.
They place you in a studio, and you have to stay there, or at least when I was there, you had to stay there where they placed you for at least 2 years. And then you could choose to move on to a more specifically disciplined studio.
Okay.
So I got placed in Strasbourg, which was a method acting focused studio. And there was also a Meisner studio and an Atlantic studio, which is Mamet stuff. There was a musical theater studio. There was a studio called Playwrights Horizons.
So based on one audition,
yeah,
some small committee of people, like, determined your fate for the next 2 years.
Pretty much. And, you know, like, they're pretty good. They've been doing it a long time. But it certainly wasn't right for everyone.
Right.
I do feel like I ended up in the right place. I learned a ton. And I, you know, had that same love-hate relationship that everyone has to drama school and college and the new structure and everything, but I learned a ton.
Right.
I feel like most drama school turns you inside out and then turns you right side out, and everyone's like, we cried all the time, you know, it's very emotional, you're at such a pivotal point in your development. Everything's confusing, you know,
yeah.
Your hormones are all over the place. And
I wondered, you know, if there was a point where you almost lose the plot or you realize, like, to know nothing is part of the process.
Totally. There's a point, I think, probably, as you said, for every artist where you're sort of like, I feel like everything is nothing and nothing is everything and you're just drowning in your own bullshit, kind of, you know. Not bullshit, that's not the right word. But yes, probably my sophomore year of college, I was having a hard time. I often felt like I was not the most talented person in my group, or that I didn't have the best grasp on this way of approaching work. But it's funny because so far, I mean, you know, how many years now past college? I graduated in 2012. So far past college now, I actually still use so much of what I learned in school. And it's changed and adapted as needed for various projects and things. But at the time, I sort of felt like I was not an exemplary student.
What was an example of when you were having the hardest time of what that looked like?
So I had a teacher who I actually recently wrote sort of a little thank you to, who we used to do something called sense memory, which the basic idea behind it, as far as I understand it anyway, is that your senses remember better than your brain does. So I once had a teacher say that you know, if you felt snow when you were 3 years old, you might not remember it, but that somewhere your body probably does remember what it feels like to feel snow, is the very basic idea. It's a whole thing. But we used to do a lot of sense memory exercises in class. And I had a teacher who would, we'd all be on a stage, and it was exercise. You know, you were developing your skills, and it was so frustrating. And teacher would push us and push us and push us and tell us to take it further and do more, and she would pull students off of the stage as they reached wherever, you know, we were aiming for, whatever that meant, wherever she wanted us
some
to be.
Some weird finish line that you didn't even
really
understand.
Yeah, some weird finish line you can't really find. Whenever they got there, they would get pulled off the stage. And I remember once being the last person on the stage.
Oh, that's horrible.
Who apparently hadn't gotten there and was, you know, like.
And at that point, are you like, what does she want to hear so
like,
I can fake it?
Yeah, what is it? You know, and I'm like, you know, I was probably like crying and like trying to feel the rain or something. And I was so mad about it. You know, like went home and was like, what am I doing? I feel so fucked up, and you know, was very indulgent in all of my own feelings, and I'm not sure that was any specific cathartic moment in any way, but I do look back on that moment sometimes, and I kept thinking in class, and I'm sure that so many drama students go through this. I kept thinking, we're never going to use this like this. This is not acting. This is not what this is going to look like. We're never going to use
weird,
this in the real world. What is
exercise.
This?
You know? Yeah.
And then I shot, I remember very distinctly, an episode of House of Cards where a character is having a really, really intense breakdown where everything just collapsed. And we shot that scene for like 12 hours. And I remember going, dang, like, I never would have been able to do this if it weren't for that fucking class where we had to sit on the stage for 2 hours feeling feelings and rain and, you know, like, and pushing them as far as we knew how.
Yeah.
I just remember being like, oh, crap, that was it. 12 hours of trying to have, like, this intense emotional breakdown and realizing that without the kind of training that I had had, I probably would not have been able to do that or to sustain it. And it was the things that I learned in school that came around full circle. And I think I wrote her a note just being like, hey, thanks. You know?
That is so interesting, because I bet there wasn't one student in that class that understood the lesson they were actually learning that
day. No way. You can't. Isn't that the best part about school? You don't really understand until later on in your life when you're like, oh, shit. I mean, I'm waiting for the moment where I need to know algebra. That hasn't happened yet.
Then you're right. You're in trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it brings up the idea that acting is a total mystery, right? And that anything is valid to use. And
isn't that all art, though?
I guess
so. Art is a total mystery. You never know. I mean, how many painters died and people didn't appreciate their work until after they were gone? You know, I feel that way about art in general. It feels never like something you can grab or hold on to. And that's why it's so hard to teach. How do you teach that?
Right.
You have to just give people a toolbox and they have to be able to make it their own.
You know, I always wonder about whether or not those kinds of experiences, like you described, if they add to your confidence or take it away. I think there's some people that leave drama school losing every shred of confidence or belief that they had talent, right?
Yeah, both, I think, depending on who you are, and maybe both. It's something I think about a lot, but probably for me, both at the same time, honestly. But also that's just sort of, I feel like I've talked so much recently about all my anxiety, you know, like, but I feel like when I really love something, I'm the most anxious about it and feel the most vulnerable doing it. And
just, it's almost a sign that it's the right thing you should be doing.
Yeah, like this show, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, I've never been so terrified at any given moment ever in my whole life. And equally, at the same time, so satisfied. I feel really fulfilled and petrified simultaneously, and that's the best feeling. Without necessarily being able to, I would never have been able to articulate that, but I think that's it. I think that's what I was always looking for.
is to scare yourself.
Yeah, actors say that all the time. I want to do things that scare me.
But what does that really mean? Like, you don't want to be uncomfortable all day, every day.
Some people are, and it's probably not a nice feeling, but there's something, I don't know, there's something so masochistic about it, but but that is kind of it. I mean, while I'm working, not on every job, but on the ones that I've cared about the most.
Right.
This sounds so depressing, but I often do like walk around being like, why have I done this? Everyone, this is the last job I'll ever have. Everyone hates this and me and everyone will hate everything, you know? And it's not until you're out the other side that you're like, oh, I did a thing and I'm proud of it, actually. And even if I haven't seen it, I'm proud that I did it and I'm still here.
And then you went through it.
I'm not dead. You
right.
know?
Well, this
hopefully
to
not everyone hates me.
This to me is the great mystery about acting is that, like, I think your House of Cards character is a great example.
Thanks.
Because, you know, in those early scenes, you're playing a call girl. And by the way, how'd that call go with your father? I got a
My
job.
My dad didn't. I don't think he's ever seen it.
Oh, really?
I don't think he's ever seen the show. Yeah, he likes to hear about it from other people, but I don't think he's ever seen it. Let me just say that this is their favorite job I've ever had. They're thrilled. I'm not dying. I'm not crying
for sure.
All the time.
And you're
they
dressed fabulously.
And they make sure to tell me all the time so that I keep doing stuff like this.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't they know by now that they got to tell you to do something opposite?
Now they're on board. I think at this point I've proven it. Now they're sort of like, we trust you, whatever you want to do.
Well,
but please stop dying.
No, but I think that in House of Cards, you know, those first couple scenes, you're trying to seduce this senator, and there's a level of confidence and control going on with your character that, like, because really you're in the position of power in that opening scene when you're giving him the hotel key, right? And that's the great mystery of acting to me, is that what I'm hearing you say is probably all day on that set, you are assuming you're about to get fired, or you're thinking that
it's
you don't
know. It's less on set and more at home. That, you know, like, and it's been extreme. I mean, my final episode of House of Cards, I was so nervous because the material was so great, and I'd been given this enormous gift of this kind of epic departure after having spent 2 and some change unexpected years on this show. That final episode was such an enormous gift.
I can imagine.
And I just didn't want to fuck it up.
Yeah. Well, isn't that the definition of an artist, though, is that you're less nervous about anything for yourself, like getting fired or anything. You want to live up to the material.
Yes, absolutely. Especially with such great material. And I've been privileged to have that on these projects and other projects. Even when I was in smaller roles, the material has always been, mostly always been really excellent.
Well, but I think in the beginning of a career, you know, because you've said, smaller roles in other shows and things like that. I'm sure that House of Cards thing at the beginning probably looked like one of those to you, right? It's two episode arc.
That's right.
Five, six lines.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a funny thing too,
yeah.
that opportunities in this world come up in the strangest places.
Absolutely. That was so against type for me at the time. I was playing 16 and sort of sweet, and I was definitely told before coming in, you know, put a lot of makeup on, wear like a tighter dress, and don't smile in your audition. Yeah.
These are the things that make you look old.
Yeah, seem a little bit older than you are. But I do remember my first day showing up on that set. I came as myself, which then I looked, you know, I had no makeup on. I actually have a photo from the first day of set somewhere of Michael Kelly and I screwing around. And I'm wearing this white sweater that says XOXO on it. Got my hair back, no makeup on. And I remember Fincher coming. Yeah, we were going in for a rehearsal and David Fincher came in and goes, "Are you even fucking legal?" And I was like, "That's it, I'm fired," you know?
Were there periods of that shoot where, I don't know, that idea that this can't last and they're going to find out and...
Totally. I think that's every project, but yes, definitely. And I learned a lot about myself. It felt like a character that was so far out of reach. It felt like something I didn't have access to and I didn't know where that lived. And I feel like I grew up with Rachel Posner. I am probably different out the other side of working on that project. There's a certain point where you have to be ready. You're ready or you're not. You know?
Right, right.
But yeah, and it's grown and evolved a lot because I've been so fortunate to be able to work on projects that are so vastly different. I worked on two projects simultaneously. I worked on the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel pilot and then went into a production of Othello in New York and then went back and shot the first season of the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And I'd never done comedy and never done Shakespeare. And so it felt like simultaneously it was amazing. I was learning so much and there was a lot to learn that I'd never learned before. And the same with comedy, you know, that they're just people. You're saying lines, but there is something to learn about rhythm and about landing a joke. And with Amy's dialogue, there's much more thinking on the line than there is between the line, and Shakespeare is actually the same. There's not pregnant pauses like there are in so many other projects, and I felt like I'd really come to love, you know, thinking between the lines and discovering things in the moment on camera, and realized that I was doing that more in silences than on my lines, and that was a big learning process approaching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel particularly,
right.
But also Othello. Was being able to speed up the process, literally, to a degree that I had never done before. And that was probably the part that was more difficult than the comedy. Amy also writes in a rhythm, and it's much faster
than anything.
Right, Amy Palladino,
who created.
Amy Sherman Palladino, who created The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, writes in a rhythm that I had never tried to work in before. The idea that I now go into a project going, I have no idea how I'm going to approach this. But there is a core of training. Certainly there are things that can't be taught. But I can say with 100% certainty that I wouldn't be here without the training. And I hate to use the word rules, but, you know, a set of whatever that other word is for rules to abide by and then to learn how to break and make your own. There was a solid foundation to jump off from.
Right.
And there are things that I can turn to when I'm in trouble or when something isn't working to try and help me out of a bind. I can always go back to that foundation. But it is a lot of time spent looking at the arc of the story and thinking about what brought these characters to this point, pivotal moments that maybe are or are not mentioned in the script, collaboration with directors and writers to figure out what some of those are, and then
happened between the end of chapter
yes,
three and
exactly.
the beginning of chapter four.
My favorite part.
Yeah.
But what happened to get them to this point? You know, like in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, for example, I asked Amy about 1,000 questions about, you know, it's referred a lot that Midge went to Bryn Mawr. Well, at that time, a young Jewish woman going to Bryn Mawr wasn't standard. So was she the only Jewish woman at Bryn Mawr? What was that like? Was she hiding that? Was she celebrating it? You know, questions like that.
But that's interesting that you'd want to know how she came to be at a school where she wouldn't likely end up there. And so how does that make her different? And you want to know that from, because you have all that training and those rules to break or not break. But at a certain point, you have to go into an empty room and sit down, and you're going to have to make some decisions.
Yeah.
And commitments.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you're going to have to come out and go, okay, this is the way I'm doing this.
Yes.
And that's a process that you have to develop for yourself, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
For people who haven't seen the show yet, the thing I love about it is you get to see a woman accidentally discovering that she is an artist, mm-hmm. and discovering it in the best way, which is she finds herself on stage at the Gaslight in a drunken rant, I guess. After her life has just fallen apart at her most vulnerable, she finds out people respond to her. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of wish fulfillment as an artist. Like, gosh, wouldn't it be great if my innermost troubles were relatable and people were drawn to those things?
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, for me, that's what really pulled me into the show is, oh, the moment when someone discovers they're an artist.
Yeah.
And not just an artist who can, who can do things, but an artist who can give voice to other people's vulnerabilities, right?
Yeah.
And then the other beautiful thing about the show is that you get to dive deep via the production design and costume design and locations into this world of 1950s New York and see what comedy clubs were like then.
Yeah, I love to research. I'm a research nerd. So I did a deep dive. I watched every documentary I could get my hands on about pioneering comedians of that time. It's a brilliant Joan Rivers documentary. On Netflix. It's so good.
And Joan Rivers was so funny.
So funny and so fascinating.
Yes.
And it dives into how and why she became who she was, but also why she was such a big deal then. And very similarly to Midge, she talked a lot about subject matters that were considered completely taboo.
It makes you think about what women had to go through at that point. So I guess I'm wondering, as you're watching all of this, you have to sort of embody a different period in time, and then on top of that, you have to embody like a comedic persona or comedic timing and everything. It must have been a big task.
It felt big, but it was fun, and I felt that I knew the way in, which is really that Midge is a woman whose whole life fell apart.
Right.
She's just talking. And it so happens that her perspective, her unique perspective on the world is fucking funny. And she's sharp and smart, and she doesn't know how to do anything halfway. She's pretty single-minded. You know, when she gets on something, she can't let it go. And coming in that way made it seem less daunting. Having familiarized myself with what the scene was like, what New York was like in the 1950s, what it meant to be a young Jewish woman in the 1950s. There's a great documentary called The Jewish Americans, which chronicles the entire history, sort of significant year by year, of Jewish families in America, which taught
me a ton. You are a research nerd.
Yeah, I love to research. Yeah. I just wanted to know as much as I could so that I had to do the least amount of pretending. I didn't necessarily feel like when I started I knew exactly who this woman was. And sometimes it's the other way. Sometimes you're like, I know who this person is. What's everything else like? How does she walk? How does she talk? How does she, you know? And
right.
I sort of went the other way. I kind of went, well, here's the whole world and here's all these different elements. And so that might mean that she walks and talks like this, or that might mean that, you know, and pieced some things together and tried some stuff before I really felt like I was able to understand the inside stuff. And that was not necessarily a way that I had worked before.
Right.
But a way that I loved working. And just, you know, really it's all kind of fear-based, isn't it? It's really just so that you can show up on the first day and feel as confident as you possibly can.
Right.
In a situation that's always scary and
right, that first day is
never
looming.
Gets easier, yeah.
And you're like, I need some things to hang on
to
here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Did you go out and watch comedians live?
I did. I watched a couple of those specials on Netflix of comedians that are great now. I loved Ali Wong's special, Baby Cobra. It was so much fun. And then was more interested, though, in sort of beginning and mid-level comedy clubs, because there are different levels of comedian that perform at all those different spaces.
You wanted to see someone who wasn't totally polished.
Yeah.
Like, what were you trying to notice?
I was mostly looking for, especially at the beginning, was a lot of people performing for the first time, or a lot of people who were trying out new material, or people who were sort of stuck at that level. And that was really interesting. Watching people succeed unexpectedly was amazing. Watching people tell a joke that they thought was good, but like a joke that really landed, and the kind of surprise and confidence that they were infused with moving into their other jokes that maybe aren't the funniest jokes, but because they feel confident delivering them, they land.
Right.
Or just watching people bomb and how they deal, because people deal differently. You know, some comedians will acknowledge that they're bombing, and that feels kind of like a confidence thing. Or sometimes something to cover up how unconfident you feel. But some comedians are fine being like, that sucked and you're not laughing at that. How about this one? You know, or I watched a girl, it still hurts. I watched a girl just tank. I mean, it tanked so badly. It was just sad and not funny, and you could hear a pin drop in the audience. And rather than continue, she just really slowly like hung up the mic and then just walked off the stage. And as she was walking off, it's not funny, but it's really funny. As she was walking off, the mic dropped. And it was so sad, but really good. And I was just trying to see mostly how people responded to success and failure at a beginning stage when you don't really know what you're doing and you haven't had enough experience to know how to handle a heckler. You know, I was so curious about how people handled hecklers when they were first starting. And, you know, I went to a show where there was a guy in the front row who was just stoned out of his brains and was sleeping. It was just various stages of falling asleep and getting up and, like, you know, right in the front. So every comedian that went up there saw this guy, and he was fucking with everyone, you know. And some comedians ignored him completely. There were some comedians who kept sort of nervously glancing at him but decided not to acknowledge it, and there were some who took the guy to town. It was that kind of thing. I was just sort of looking to see what the spectrum looked like of how people dealt with success and failure and hecklers and at different levels.
Have you ever been on stage as yourself in front of an audience?
Presenting. I've presented at some award shows and things.
Is that a comfortable space for
it's
you?
It's not the same as acting. People are like, you're an actor. It's not the same. There's nothing worse than having to be yourself and get up on a stage and do something. I don't know.
Was there some understanding from watching these comedians of how different of a job it is than your job?
Yes. I could never do what they do. I could never do that. I could never put my whole self-worth on the line for a laugh. I bow down. I'm in complete awe and admiration for what they for all the things that they do.
And it's not something you desired, like, throughout your research. You never thought, well, I should probably go try to do 2 minutes.
You know, everyone kept asking that, and I think at one point Amy told me that she'd write me something and I should go do it. And I just was like, I think I've been saying this now because it feels like the only comparison. If you are playing a doctor on TV, you should not try to perform surgery. It would not go well. And then maybe you'd be so traumatized, you would no longer be able to play a doctor on TV. I feel the exact same way about comedy. You should not try that, because if it works, I'm not even sure it's useful if it works, but if it fails, I don't think I could ever get back up on a stage and play a comedian and feel like I could be any good at it.
Oh, that's interesting. So you feel like by not ever doing it, somewhere in your head you can go, yeah, but I know how that's done. And go up and fail.
Yeah, that would be so traumatizing.
That would kill your confidence.
And as somebody who doesn't want to be a stand-up, I'm not about the failing and then getting back on the horse and trying it again until I figure it out. I'm not a stand-up. I don't have that skill set. It's not one I'd like to hone, you know. But as another character with material that's written for me and an audience that is told where to laugh, by the
sure.
way.
You know, sure.
Like, I can't claim to have ever actually done stand-up. editing is my friend, but I also noticed at the same time that there was a big growth process between doing it in this very strange format that is sort of stand-up adjacent.
Right, because you're still the only person on stage. The cameras are pointed at you.
Yeah.
You don't know all these extras. They're not people.
No, that's exactly right.
So there must have been a heightened sense of nervousness from other scenes that you've done in the past as an actor.
Totally. It was terrifying,
despite
the fact that all of those things were true. Horrifying, absolutely. I spent many a minute in like power pose in my corset, in my dressing room, like trying to psych myself up to go out there and be as comfortable as Midge needs to be. It was fucking hard. But I learned a ton, you know. From the beginning to the end of the season, became able to distinguish between laughs, like when they were laughing because they were supposed to laugh, and when they were laughing because I had done something that made them laugh.
Timing-wise.
And I became more comfortable playing, became more comfortable not trying to hit jokes the same way in every take, became more comfortable with the idea of failing and knowing that there would be another take. And it got better as it went on. I got better as Midge got better, and I still have a ton to learn, but I'm excited about it.
Right.
It was a really interesting parallel journey for us. I'll never be as good a stand-up as Midge is, but I learned a ton.
Well, I have to go back to the moment when Amy Sherman-Palladino asks you, she says, oh, I'll write a few minutes for you. So you, like, how do you sort of shut down your director and say, no, I'm not going to do that.
I think I just went, no, 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 you get up there, you know, like, you do it.
Well, it makes me curious in school if you ever had to do, like, an improv class.
So we didn't do a ton in my particular program. We didn't do a ton. I should have. Improv still scares the shit out of me.
It does.
Yes.
So you have this little dark corner of your profession that you haven't fully
entered. Most of it scares the shit out of me. I wish that I had done more improv. Maybe one day I'll get brave enough to go to a Groundlings class or something. But in a similar vein, it's not always comedy improv, but I find it a similar skill set in some ways to stand up. It's also totally different, but there's something that feels similar about those worlds, even though obviously stand-up is jokes that you've written and practiced and sets that you've honed 100 times. But being in the moment with your audience and being able to read your audience and respond to them and be in the scene with them, as it were, is improvisational in some way. I mean, I'm not sure I'm as quick as those guys.
Well, it brings up a question. If you were able to put some more of your own true emotional experiences into this character because you're an artist playing an artist.
The part that felt so hard to access, all of that stuff about backstage, was more about Midge's inherent confidence and self-empowerment. The work, especially when it's something you love, I think any artist can relate to this, it feels vulnerable. It feels really vulnerable. You feel like you're naked on stage. It was more about being able to access that level of self-empowerment and self-confidence. I think I realized through the course of this project that I've never played a character who is so self-assured. She believes inherently that if she works hard enough, she can achieve anything she sets her mind to. And that's always been true for her.
Well, I wonder if you can learn from a character, even though this character is fully a creation of a writer, can you, by, like you said, being a research nerd and embodying this person, can you become more confident? Or can you take parts of her and incorporate them into you?
I think you always take away parts of characters that you play for any extended period of time with you. I think some of it's, most of it's probably not on purpose. But yes, I think I'll have a better answer for that in a few years.
Yeah.
That's something I'm never really sure about until I'm removed from a project. It's only in hindsight that I look back on my time on House of Cards and realize that what I took away from that character was a groundedness that I'm not sure I had before that project. I walked away more firmly with 2 feet on the ground. My voice changed from playing that character.
Interesting.
I think I found a version of my voice that was slightly more on voice and had spent so much time doing it that it became part of me too.
Right.
And actually was like a very natural and organic part of me that I didn't know I had, I suppose.
Well, the word confidence has come up a lot in relationship to Midge.
Yeah. And
is it possible to sort of learn through observation what makes confidence or how you can generate confidence?
I'm not sure. I think so much of confidence comes with age and experience.
Right.
Because I can certainly say that I feel more comfortable doing this with you now today than I would have 4 years ago, or even 2 years ago, or maybe even a year ago.
Right.
But I'm not sure how much of that I picked up from Midge versus how much has been that I've now done it more and I'm feel more comfortable being myself and having to perform less in these kinds of situations. In my own life, I would describe myself as a pretty confident person. When it comes to my work, that's something that personally I've always struggled with. And I think that goes hand in hand with loving it as much as I do and wanting it to be as fulfilling and wanting to be great at it. That's
right.
Some way that I can relate to Midge, that when that line came up in the script, I was like, I get that. She says, I want to be the best at this. I want to be great at this. And that has always meant that it just feels vulnerable to be working on something that I love. And so it was more about being able to find how to access that in a work environment. And so probably, I'm sure I've grown a lot from that exercise, from trying to do that every single day at work.
What you're saying makes total sense because you're sort of describing ambition in the sense.
Yes, yeah,
right?
Totally.
But you're also describing vulnerability that comes from
yeah.
loving something so much that there's a great responsibility that comes mm-hmm. along with it.
Yeah.
Would you trust that you were doing great if you felt super great all the time?
No. I think it's now become a part of the whole, this unreachable process thing, you know, that if I don't feel absolutely terrible, it's probably not good, you know? But that's even hard to grab onto in the moment.
But I think that's the conundrum of doing something like this, is
yeah.
that how do you find that balance of, you don't want to feel like crap every day.
Yeah, it's not great.
No, but you do want to serve the higher art that may right. require that.
Right.
And that's sort of right, you're right in the middle of that right now.
Yeah, hopefully this is just the beginning of a long career where every idea that I've ever had and everything I've ever said in this interview gets completely undone, you know?
Like, right.
Who knows? And that's exciting.
And you come back in 5 years and we talk about your
and you're
wrestling.
Like, remember when you said this? And I'm like, that was a ridiculous idea.
Yeah. I knew
that's
nothing.
That's not how it works.
But that's what your 20s are for. Your 20s are to, like, feel everything.
Yeah, it feels
so
strange.
And have highs and lows and...
Totally. Well, it feels so strange when people are like, want you to be the authority on anything at this
right.
point.
Right,
like, I don't have the answers. I don't know what to tell you. Yeah, that feels like such a strange... People are like, look back on your career, and I'm like, I feel like it's still happening.
Yeah. Well, but I think that's the greatest compliment to the work you're doing because you've obviously created something that people are drawn to enough to where they go, oh, I want to know everything she's thinking about everything because this character has drawn me in or this show has drawn me in, you know?
Yeah, and that's cool.
That's a sign that you're doing something right.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
And,
you too.
And I hope this show goes for several seasons.
Thanks.
Selfishly.
You too.
And I think that when we do things that stretch us, that scare us, growth has to happen, right? And you're like right in the middle of the most exciting, you know, growth spurt in your life. And it's, I don't know, it's fascinating to watch. So
thanks.
Thank you for telling me about it.
Yeah, thank you. You're great at this.
I'm. Thank you. But everything you feel about, you know, I feel the same exact stuff.
Isn't that nice to know?
Oh, yeah.
That also creates empowerment. I feel like I've spoken to so many different artists who are like, it never gets easier. And you're like, that's good to know.
It's true. I don't think it ever gets easier. I think when it does get easier, you don't trust it.
That's right. And maybe you shouldn't.
And maybe you shouldn't. Yeah. Although it would be nice to just
it would be a
go
little,
to bed some
be
days just
nice.
Going, yeah, I'm pretty good at
being
this.
Like, That was a good day.
Everything's fine, and tomorrow will be good.
Tomorrow will be even better. Maybe yeah. one day we'll both
Who
get there.
Who feels that?
No one. Robots. Sociopaths.
Robots.
Donald Trump.
There you go. And that's nothing to aspire to.
No, no. No, no. No, thank you. Thank you, though.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, folks, that's our show. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't yet, go watch The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. It's on Amazon, and it is a great show. You'll love it, and you'll be caught up just in time for season two. So check that out. And also, if you haven't seen Rachel in House of Cards, that's quite an engaging storyline, too. So check that out. You know what else is quite an interesting storyline? Our storyline. And you can dive deep into the entire off-camera storyline by going to our website, offcamera.com. There you'll find every one of our 150 episodes, all available for your perusal. And the best way to do that is by getting an off-camera subscription. That's right, for $4.99 a month, you can watch every episode we've ever made on any device as many times as you want. It's a great way to dive into the show and pick up on all the wisdom from all of these iconic artists that have appeared on our show in the last 4 years. And if you love the podcast, I'm happy to announce that in addition to finding us on iTunes and everywhere else you can find podcasts, we are also now on Spotify. And hey, while you're at our website, check out our store. We make a special magazine for every artist that comes on the show, and they are all available in the off-camera store. And there you can see the exclusive photographs that we take of every artist that appears here. You can also get our off-camera The Portraits coffee table book. There are still a few signed editions left, and they make a great gift and a great addition to your coffee table. So check that out, and know when you buy anything on the store, you are supporting Off Camera, and you're helping us to keep bringing the show to you every week. So spend some time on the Off Camera site and tell your friends about Off Camera. If you want to find us on social, we are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. You can also send me an email at sam@offcamera.com. I love guest suggestions, comments, criticisms. Well, I don't love criticisms, but I like hearing what everyone thinks of the show. So send me what's on your mind. As always, I want to thank our talented and hardworking crew for everything they do to make this show a reality each week. Crawford Chippy, Nathan Shields, Michaela McGalvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, and Matt Davidson. Matt's actually on hiatus this week to get a few bunions removed, but he'll be back next week, so never fear. And most importantly, make sure you tune in next time when I sit down with actress Alison Brie.
What's great about Glow to me is it's just very different to shoot a show that's not made through the male gaze. It's just like our set. I think it makes such a difference having women at the top. They're where the buck stops. It stops with them. They're our bosses. They're determining what the content should be. And we're wearing next to nothing. But we're so far from being objectified. It feels like you're in our house.
I first discovered Alison on two shows simultaneously, Mad Men and Community. But it took me more than a few episodes of each to realize I was watching the same actress. And I marveled at this woman who could handle period drama and contemporary comedy with equal dexterity. So it was surprising to me to hear how fully she identified with her Netflix show, Glow, in which she plays a struggling actress who ends up on an 80s all-female wrestling show. Glow brilliantly satirizes bad 80s cable television while taking a hard look at sexism and inequality for women in the arts. The experience has been both empowering and enlightening for Alison and her castmates, revealing what female-centric storytelling can be at its best, while also bringing to light the stark contrast between the Glow set and every other production that Alison has ever worked on. See you next time, off camera.